5, 4, 3,
and cue Jeff.
2,
so you'll need a fresh
1,
pineapple,
6
ounces of marshmallows, 20 maraschino cherries, count them carefully, won't you?
30 seconds.
Cream, back caster in. Sugar, and lemon juice.
And mix.
Right, we'll come out next. It's the southeast weather.
You could have left the clock,
like it's
going
to be another cold, dull day again, much like
20
yesterday.
Seconds.
Coming back to 2.
The top temperature, about 4 degrees centigrade, or 39 Fahrenheit.
Counting to what back in? 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net. All right, this is show number 11, chapters 12 through 15 of The Moon Pool by Abraham Merritt. This past Sunday, I did not read The Skylark of Space by Doc Smith, because, as it turned out, the parcel of books, which I was anticipating to receive, sort of vanished into the ether. The tracking information ceased, and I don't know what happened, to be perfectly honest. But it's shown up again, and I expect it to be delivered today. And so I think I can say with some confidence that I will be reading Skylark this coming Sunday. Now, in the meantime, did I read? I did, in fact, read. What did I read? Well, I mentioned to you before that there is at least one case where Doc Smith wrote a sequel to a story by Merritt, and so I read those two stories. They will undoubtedly show up as padding in these transmissions at some future date, but within the next 10-12 days, you can go and see them by visiting my Twitch channel, which would be twitch.tv/publiuslector, which is Papa Uniform Bravo Lima India Uniform Sierra Lima Echo Charlie Tango Oscar Romeo. The titles of the two stories, by the way, are The Last Poet and the Robots and Robot Nemesis. And they really read as though there are...
...shortly here, and H-10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out.
Hello?
Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
So yes, as I said on Mastodon, I am taking a break from my Thanksgiving dinner here in Munich. Since there is, of course, no Thanksgiving holiday in Munich, Americans in Munich frequently have Thanksgiving gatherings with their friends, which they will do whenever is convenient. And so that happened to be today. So here I am. I just had some really good mashed potatoes. They were roasted rather than boiled before mashing. Anyway. So. I had an alarm set to remind me, but I still had food on my plate. So I didn't want to give that up. So yes, you can hear them in the background. I think I'm going to go shut the door now so that they're so that the sound of the people having fun doesn't completely overwhelm my voice. But you should know that there are people having fun and eating delicious food. Mostly finished with the eating delicious food part of the evening, but not completely. I didn't even have any of the red cabbage. I should probably have some of that, but I'm not sure how well it would go with the dessert. There's a mango cobbler. Yeah, my mashed potatoes usually have skin on because I'm too lazy to peel potatoes. I also make a variant on Cole Cannon. Ask me sometime about how you can make a delicious variant on Cole Cannon. Because, seriously, the standard Irish Cole Cannon, not a big fan. I'm not a huge fan of most cabbage dishes, but red cabbage sometimes. But the green cabbage, I'm not a big fan. But I found, you know, there are a number of cruciferous vegetables. Well, there's one of them that I like a lot, and that's broccoli. So I have a Cole Cannon variant that I make with broccoli, and it is good. So yeah, you know, cruciferous vegetables are practically second only to grains as the staff of life, you know, as herbs of, pardon me, food crops. Sorry about the coughing, I still had some mashed potatoes caught in my throat, clearly. But yeah, I'm not a huge fan of most cruciferous vegetables, but broccoli I love. I always have. I had Romanesco recently. And the only thing I can say is Romanesco is broccoli if it were created by Giordano Bruno. All mathematical perfection. Tobe is threatening me with potato-related on-air death. Of course, he's just as likely to have that happen as I am, considering his potato cannons. Potato cannon-related injuries are no joke. Gracious. Okay, I think I'm going to be okay now. But I'm going to get myself another glass of water. So if you'll excuse me just a moment, there's a pitcher of water on the thing just outside. People are talking in com about an SDF cookbook. Well, we do have SDF music albums. Why not? All right. So where was I? What was I going to talk about today? Oh, yes. Here's my little notebook. What does the little notebook say? Ah, yes. So I'm going to start with a couple of quotes, and I'm going to let you think about these two quotes, because I found them very interesting. So these are both from things that I've read on my other show recently. The first is from a guy named Klaus Knorr, who was a law professor of foreign affairs at Princeton. From a paper he wrote entitled American Foreign Policy and the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy for the 12th American Assembly in October of 1957. And this is what he wrote, talking specifically about the potential value of nuclear energy for the underdeveloped countries of the world. He says, "The simple fact is that the retardation of economic progress in many parts of the world is the proximate result of low rates of saving, investment, and innovation, and of a disinclination to search continuously for new ways of employing scarce economic resources more efficiently. Ultimately, economic retardation results largely from a structure of relevant motivations, deeply embedded in traditional cultures, which inhibits or obstructs changes on the level of the proximate conditions of poverty. It is on changes in these basic levels that economic development depends, and no amount of cheap electricity can substitute for them." Well, here's another view from the Three Wise Men of Euratom, from 1957, very same year, about 6 months previously. And this is the very first paragraph in the report proper. "In the 19th century, coal, produced cheaply and abundantly, multiplying a hundredfold the effectiveness of human effort, turned Europe into the workshop of the world. In the last 5 years of post-war expansion, Europe has suddenly discovered that this favorable situation has entirely changed, and that a new fact conditions all its prospects. The shortage of energy threatens to become a major break on economic growth. This is the context in which the new prospects opened up by nuclear power plant must be assessed. It has become a practical possibility at a turning point in Europe's economic history. In 1870, total world energy production amounted to 218 million tons of coal. Of this, the United Kingdom and our six countries together produced three quarters. The story of the industrial development of the 19th century is bound up in these figures. Britain and the continent not only powered their own unprecedented industrial progress, they were the great exporters of energy and its products to the world. Unfortunately, if Europe's internal resources of energy were abundant by the standards of 1870, it is becoming clear that by the far higher ones of 1957, and still more of 1970, they are and will be increasingly inadequate. Though today our six countries alone mine more coal than the world did in 1870, they provide only 15% of world energy production." But I want to go back. I want to go back to that first sentence. "In the 19th century, coal, produced cheaply and abundantly, multiplying a hundredfold the effectiveness of human effort, turned Europe into the workshop of the world." Right there, ladies and gentlemen, is the strongest counter-argument, I think, to what Mr. Knorr says, or Professor Knorr, or Dr. Knorr, however he would like to be addressed. The simple fact is, it is worthless to upbraid people for lack of thrift if they have nothing to save. This is often the same charge is leveled against poor people in wealthy countries as against the people in general in the poor parts of the world. Oh, well, they're just not thrifty enough. Well, if you have nothing to save, you can't save it. That multiplication by a hundredfold of human effort by the application of steam. Because let's give it its proper name, steam. I'm not necessarily a steampunk, but let's give it its proper name, steam. Oh my, a plate. The delicious, the beautiful Margaret Blake has delivered to me a plate of delicious mango cobbler.
And a carrot zucchini cake with a cream topping.
Ooh, nice. So yes, I got dessert here. It's pretty nice. Oh yeah, this is looking good, and I will try not to, you know, smack my lips and chew too much while I'm on the air, because I do want to talk during my allotted slot for talking. This is not actually the show where I eat delicious food and make delicious food-eating noises in response, although, I bet Tobe would actually, would sponsor that show. I bet I could get a sponsorship from Tobe for the delicious food-eating show. I mean, he likes to drink tea on air, but delicious food. Yeah. Mango. That's good. But yes, what good is it to upbraid the poor for their lack of thrift if they have nothing to save? It's that multiplication. Multiplication by 100-fold, now more like 1,000-fold of human effort by the application of steam. And nowadays, of course, primarily by the application of electricity, but much of that electricity is generated by steam. That's where we're at. I mean, I don't want to sound like, oh God, Ninja High School, Professor Steamhead. I'm not, if you get the reference, you get the reference. If not, I'm not going to try to explain it to you. But that's the thing, is that technology has multiplied by vast amounts the productivity of human labor in those countries which are able to apply it. And yes, of course there are social factors. But the plain fact is, the social factors in Europe were not the most conducive to prosperity. If you look at the history of the 17th and 18th centuries, it's fairly clear that capitalism in England, in fact, you might even go back to the 15th, 16th centuries, but certainly 17th and 18th centuries, it's fairly clear that capitalism in Britain nearly collapsed the economy. That comparatively to the conditions, the productivity and the rate of advance of living standards in the peasant and guild economy of the late Middle Ages was greater than under the capitalistic economy of the early modern period. This is masked somewhat, but not completely, by colonialism. I mean, the English colonies in the New World were not moneymakers, except insofar as they were occasionally able to steal a shipload of silver and gold from the Spanish. Of course, the biggest interest the British had in North America was actually in old-growth timber to be used as masts for ships. Because much of the timber that, much of the wood in Britain, in fact across Europe, had been cut for charcoal and firewood. But if you want to know more about that, I suggest James Burke's fabulous television series, Connections, which is, what, 40, 45 years old now? And I'm not even mad that it's still one of the best things of its kind that's ever been made. That's a free recommendation for you. I do not get paid by the BBC for telling you to go look up Connections. I have a copy of the book that went with the TV series. It sits on my bookshelf at home, so it's not immediately available to me. Which is a pity, because it's good. I don't want to win a BAPE razor. I don't even know what that is. Stop sending me emails like that. That's disturbing. That is a precondition of saving, is having something to save. Now, is it true that social conditions in many parts of the world are not conducive to economic advancement and prosperity? Undoubtedly, it is true. I sometimes wonder, immigration is such a fascinating subject, because, of course, it's not just where you're going to, it's where you're coming from, and vice versa. And so I sometimes wonder about immigrants who complain about being expected to act like the people in the country that they're moving to, because it strikes me that presumably the reason that you're moving to the country is that you like it better than the country you started off in, and the conditions there are caused by the behavior of the people, and therefore you'd think that emulating the behavior of the people in the country you're going to would be just be the smart move, because it helps to assure that the country you're moving to will remain the country that you wanted to move to. I don't know. I think it's a difficult problem. Because, obviously, I'm not going to say, no, you have to act exactly like these people. No, I mean, that's not great either, all right? That, yes, I understand people don't want to leave their cultures behind. They don't want to leave their food behind. They don't want to leave their language behind. They don't want to leave their religion behind. And to a great extent, I think, there's no reason why they should. Bluntly speaking, most countries can only benefit by being enriched by that kind of new addition, if they can integrate it effectively. You know, the worst thing that happens is, as has happened in Sweden in the past 15 years or so, with the unpleasant result that they have bombings all the time. The worst thing that can happen is when you have people sort of sealed up in airtight boxes. You know, there's lots of Afghans and Somalis and so forth who've been taken in as refugees by Northern European countries who have no history of immigration, to be perfectly blunt. See, OptiFX asked Jazzmaz if he spent time in Chicago. I believe Jazzmaz is a native Chicagoan, Chicagoite, whatever they call them. Northern European countries who have no significant history of immigration. The plain fact is that from Norway and Sweden in the 19th century, something like half or three quarters of the population of Norway moved to America. The country was almost totally depopulated. The only immigrants they've gotten were people who came back, because the forgotten story of Northern European immigrants, Irish, Norwegian, whoever, to America, is that many of them said, well, I'm going to stay there long enough to make my fortune, and then I'm going to go back. And something like 40% of them actually did. And I wonder what that indicates about the possible future of space colonization. You know, it's been said that there are no white Alaskans, that all white people in Alaska are transients. People move to Alaska to make money, and then they move back to the lower 48. I don't know, right? These are difficult issues, difficult questions, difficult problems. But from my point of view, moving to an O'Neill colony where you can go up to the center of the cylinder, strap on wings, and fly, I don't know if I would want to move back to Earth. On the other hand, Earth has sunsets. Earth has landscapes. Earth occasionally has avalanches, which are imposing to watch from a distance, although you'd rather not be in one. So I really do wonder what that portends. But ultimately, you've got... But yeah, as I say, in these, there are places in Sweden, Denmark, and so on, where... People say this about France, but it's much less true. You know, if you're walking down the street in Paris, you absolutely will encounter French-speaking, Algerians, people from Central Africa, whatever, but it's all a hubbub. You know, you're bumping elbows with everybody. You go down to the crepe stand, and there's a halal option, because the guys running the crepe stand are Algerians or Moroccans or something. I speak from experience, okay? I was in Paris for one night, and by the time I got my... I went to the Mint Museum, obviously, because this is me we're talking about. I came back, I messed around for a little while, and then when I looked up, I realized, man, I'm hungry, it's time for dinner, and I realized it was later than I thought. And most places were closed, except Burger King. I said, well, there's no way in hell I'm going to eat Burger King or McDonald's in Paris. I was surprised that the restaurants right around the train station closed up as early as they did, but that's life. Anyway, but there was a little stand across the street with some Moroccan or Algerian kid making crepes. And I said, yes, please. And the thing was, he had a ham option and a turkey option, which is carefully marked halal. That he, you know, wanted to have halal food for those who wanted it, but he knew he wasn't going to make money if that was all he was selling. Of course, I was also the guy who bought a falafel off of a halal vendor in New York City one time when I was in New York City on a Friday in Lent. That's my contribution to ecumenism right there, folks. Eating falafel on Fridays in Lent. So in Paris, really, you know, people talk about there being, you know, immigrant neighborhoods or whatever, but it's not really as true as you would think. There's a lot of mixing that goes on. Unfortunately, apparently in Denmark, Sweden, some places like that, there are people who they don't may not even have work permits. They certainly don't speak the local language, and as a result, they wind up, you know, they live off of state assistance in these essentially ghettos, and those places are breeding grounds for criminality, especially when a lot of the people being taken in as refugees or former child soldiers or people who grew up in a war zone and have severe PTSD and are used to violence all around them. This isn't a good thing. And the Northern European countries, they don't have any experience of this sort of thing. I mean, New York City in the turn of the 20th century, right, was a city of ethnic neighborhoods. Daniel Shore, the great news correspondent, got his start as a boy writing an article for a Yiddish newspaper because he saw a murder committed in the street in front of him. And he was literate. He was a bright young boy. He ran home, typed it up, and sold the story for a dollar or two to the Yiddish newspaper. But I don't know. I really don't know. But I don't think we're going to see too much of that in Space Settlement. I could be wrong. I've got a friend who's a writer who's written a scenario that ends up exactly like that. So I don't know. What I will say, though, and this is something that I know I harp on it a lot, the idea of the patron-client society, the idea of the society, the model of society that, please God, we can move away from, that so much of humanity has existed in for so much of its experience, this idea of the society in which there are a few people who control things, wealthy people, right, who have control of what? Medical care, education, energy supply? That's the thing. When you have large energy supply undertakings, large water supply undertakings, and so on, they're very efficient, which means they have a low unit cost, and they can be communally owned. And there are hazards that go with that, but I genuinely believe the hazards of large community-owned infrastructure, relying on, depending on, large community-owned infrastructure, very different set of hazards than relying on small, individual, household-by-household, atomized infrastructure. Each household its own energy supply. Each household its own water supply. Well, if you get crosswise with the people you live with, and nobody near you is willing to take you in, what happens to you? I genuinely believe there's far more personal freedom on the large scale, right? Possibly. It doesn't have to work out this way, but it can work out this way. There's far more scope for personal freedom in a society with large-scale infrastructure that's communally owned than with individual atomized infrastructure. That water from the tap is better than bottled water delivered to your house by a truck. I genuinely think that we need to be thinking about that. Let's see, I'm working on making some new stickers and badges with a lovely sort of atom flower logo and the motto, Split Atoms Not Wood, because of the recent revelations, well, not so recent also, about old growth forest in Canada being clear cut to be made into pellets and then shipped halfway around the world to Yorkshire and burned under the boilers at Drax, Britain's flagship green power station. Yeah, that's a hellacious bit of environmental protection for you. I also have this real interesting idea. Ask me about it next week. I think I've come up with a reasonable case for compressed air energy storage, something that I honestly thought was pointless and a bad idea for a long time. Because, see, the thing is that you need heat. Where are you going to get heat? Server farms! Anyway, I'll tell you more about it next time. You've been listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System, a wonderful thing that deserves your support. If you'd like to send your comments, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. I'll probably read them on the air. I'll probably send you some neat stuff. And you can send me money. PayPal.me/PrometheusLives is a good way if you appreciate what I'm doing here on Anon Radio. So-